Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and PT pearls to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Today on the podcast, we have Dr. Scott Lynn. Now, this is like surreal for me because let me tell you, Scott was actually, or Dr. Lynn, as I refer to him, was my professor in undergrad. And he taught biomechanics, and that's who I took biomechanics from in undergrad before I got into PT school. And during school, I actually needed prerequisites to get into grad school. And while I was taking prerequisites, I was like, okay, physics, chemistry, this stuff is boring. I'm going to continue to take biomechanics with Dr. Lynn so that I can continue to learn what I'm actually passionate and interested in. So I was taking his classes like far beyond what I needed to. I don't know how I snuck into the system, but I was with athletic trainers, people who are getting their master's in biomechanics, just so that I can continue to learn from him because he's that great of an instructor. And beyond, you know, having his PhD and his master's in orthopedic biomechanics, he currently works at Cal State University Fullerton, which is what I know him from. And he also is the director of research and education there. He's written so many and published articles, and he reviews a lot of published articles, as well as working in professional golf. He's worked in other sports like baseball, and he really is so incredible at understanding the research, understanding the human body, and understanding how it all works together. So in this podcast interview, we're really excited to dive into some of this research, understand what it means. Is it important? Do we need to understand it? What do we know about the body nowadays? And I'm just so excited to be able to have him on the podcast, bring this moment full circle from when I was an undergrad and be able to interview him here now. So I'm excited for you guys to be able to listen in. So excited to have on the podcast Dr. Lynn, my favorite instructor from undergrad, which the first time you reached out to me in email, I was like, oh my God, my favorite instructor from biomechanics is reaching out to me. Is this real life right now? But hi.
Yeah, that is, I mean, it's been funny because, I was late to the party when it comes to social media and all the stuff that, you know, a lot of people are the way they're getting their information now. And, you know, I was one that originally kind of looked down upon it, saying, you know, why do we need all this stuff and posting pictures? And, but it's the way of the world now, right? It's the way of the way people get their information. And once I did get on it, somehow, I don't remember how, one of your posts or something came across and I started looking into kind of the stuff you're doing. And I was like, this is really cool. This is, you know, a job that I didn't even know existed, you know, when I started being a professor 10 years ago or something like that. And I found it really cool that you, you know, did the traditional education and the way that, you know, you're supposed to do things. And then you kind of took this right turn and kind of invented a new way to do things, which, that's what we try to teach our students, right? Is to be innovative and to think beyond, you know, what you learned in classes. But you learned all that stuff in classes and now you're using it to do a really cool thing. And I think it's been great. You've come to talk to my students and you've really inspired a lot of them to kind of think a little bit outside the box and while still, you know, paying attention to your studies and knowing what goes on in the research and knowing, you know, going to conferences and doing all those traditional things, but then kind of applying it in a much different way. So I think that's why I really, you know, wanted to reach out because the success stories are the reason why I do what I do, right? The students mm-hmm. that go on and do really cool things is it makes it worthwhile. It was great. It's been great to reconnect and, we've worked together a little bit since then. You've come to talk to my students. So it's been awesome. It's great to see students that, show up in your classes as, I don't know, how old were you when you first took my class? You were 20 maybe or something.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And and then they go on to do these good things. I feel like I'm an old guy now, but
we don't need to say how. It's your student. Yeah. What year?
But it's all good. I like it. I don't mind at all. It's been great.
But it was great because, you know, you specifically as an instructor, what I really loved about your classroom is that you kept it very much discussion based. Like mm-hmm. You would pull something up and you'd be like, let's talk about it. Let's watch someone move. Let's see how this is happening. And I just thought that was always so amazing because it actually applied to life. It applied to the body. It kept me questioning things. It actually made me want to understand it, made me want to learn it rather than just, you know, trying to memorize something and reading out of a textbook. And it actually made it applicable to everyday life. And I feel like I even went into PT school feeling so much more just equipped with understanding the body more than some other people who maybe didn't have this kind of style of learning. So I just, the way and what you're doing and how you're helping people, you know, even just students, is amazing. I mean, obviously, we're going to get into a little bit more of what you do and how you help people, but just wanted to say that it's really incredible.
Yeah. And I think it's, I mean, as much as it's great. I love hearing stuff like that, but it's, I mean, it's more on a selfish note that I teach that way because I enjoy learning too. Right. So, I mean, I like to learn more. I mean, I think I learn more from the students in my class. Well, probably, I don't, maybe not more, but equally as much from the students in my class than I teach them. So, that's why I like it being discussion based because, you know, we'll have students in my class who are athletic trainers and who have actually been in athletic training clinics for years and years before they come to my classes. And, you know, they have some really cool stories about different injuries and maybe different perspectives, different way of thinking about things. And I think a lot of what I teach has adapted based on, you know, what I've learned from my students too. And from what I've learned from, you know, I think all of us are kind of student. I think that get into this kind of field, we're students of life, right? So I'll be going for a run along the Strand and I'll see somebody run by me and I'll stop and just like watch them run away. And some people think you're nuts, right? But you're just saying, wow, that's a really interesting pattern. I never really seen that before. And you have that rooting around in your brain for a little while trying to figure out, because I mean, I always tell my students, we don't really understand how the human body moves. Mm. There's so many little forces and things going on. And the best we have in biomechanics right now to watch movement is to go into a lab and put little dots all over you. But like most people have seen, you know, in movie animations or in video game animations, you get in those little suits with dots all over you. And that's the best way we know how to watch people move right now. But it's still not very good because those dots move relative, you know, with the muscle and the fat tissue, and they all move relative to the underlying bone. So we don't really know. We're kind of guessing at that. And then all the internal forces that cause those movements from muscles and things is even a bigger mystery. So I think that's what makes it cool to me. We're learning new and better things all the time. And I think people like yourself who are innovative, who are going out there reading the research, but then working with people every day and trying to figure out better ways to do things. You guys find some really cool stuff. And so, I mean, I think a lot of academics hide behind the like research or evidence-based practice. I only teach evidence-based practice. While evidence takes a long time to keep up with some of the cool, innovative things that a lot of people are doing in the world right now. So I think you're gonna get far behind if you hide behind that, which I have heard a lot of clinicians do. But, you know, I think the key thing that I like to see in my students are people that are wanting to learn and curious. And I think, you know, definitely saw that in you. And you've obviously gone on and done some really awesome things. And again, that's the reason why I chose the career path that I did, because you get to see those things and get some pretty good job satisfaction out of that.
Yeah.
All right. So, Dr. Lin, I've only actually met you once really in person, but the way you speak now and the way that Jen speaks about you and how you approach this, especially as a biomechanist, I appreciate so much, because you mentioned that curiosity and the curiosity of your students and how you appreciate that curiosity of your students. And really, like, that's what I hear from you. And a lot of the professors that I always appreciated the most were the professors that I realized were using us as teachers too, just like what you just said. We're asking us the questions, and we're understanding that when you have a classroom full of 30 people, regardless of, quote, what level education they have a life experience that is completely different than yours. And if we don't understand that we can reciprocally learn from each other, you know, then we're not looking at that whole picture. So I want to kind of dive back to the beginning as to where you got into biomechanics and what was your main interest of study initially, and kind of how did you initially sink your teeth into this world of biomechanics?
I mean, I think I've played sports since the time that I was born, basically. My father's a, you know, massive sports fan. He played hockey growing up and then got injured. So he got us into hockey the second we were born up in Canada, or the second we could stand up long enough without falling down. And then I have two brothers, and we're all within, I think my younger brother is 18 months younger than me. My older brother is about 2 years and 2 months older than me. So, when we were all for really young, my mom made my dad quit golf because she wasn't going to allow him to go to the golf course for 6 hours on a Saturday and leave her with all these three little boys running around. So basically he got us into golf as soon as we could stand up as well. So that I think selfishly so that he could go back and play as well. So I've played sports and it's always been a passion of mine, playing sports, moving, exercising. That kind of thing's been great. And then somewhere around the middle of, so I decided to do a kinesiology. It was called physical and health education when I did it as an undergrad degree in university, but somewhere around kind of right when I started university, I realized I was not going to be able to make my living playing sports. I wasn't good enough to at any particular sport to make my living playing sports. So I had to try and find another way. And I always tell the story, I was doing my PhD in orthopedic biomechanics. So I just kept following. I mean, I was good at science and I really liked kind of the mysteries of kind of doing scientific research. And so I was good at, you know, chemistry and biology and physics, and physics seemed to be the one that kind of interested me the most. But the first couple of weeks of regular physics, I really liked. And then we got into this wacky stuff that I was like, ooh, I don't really know about that. But then I took my first biomechanics course, which kind of applied physics to the human body and to exercising and to sports. And I was like, wow, this is something I really dig my teeth into. And so I decided to keep going to school. I had a really terrible job at the end of my undergrad in the summer where I was working for a drug company up in Toronto, Canada. And I was in a cubicle, you know, doing one of those jobs where, and I remember my boss on the very first day gave me this thing. He says, okay, here's your job, you know, get to it. And I finished it at school pace. So I was done by about 2 p.m. on the first day. I took it back to his office and I put it down. I'm like, hey, I'm done. What else do you need me to do? And he looks at me, he's like, that was for the whole week. And I was like, oh, okay. And so I found people became really inefficient in this environment and I couldn't stand it. So halfway through that summer, I called up my professor at the university that I had done an undergraduate thesis project with. And I was like, do you need a grad student? Because this working thing is not for me. And so I went back to school and I just kept doing biomechanics work. My undergrad was in my master's and PhD was in orthopedic biomechanics. And halfway through my PhD, I was golfing with a older guy that I just kind of connected with at the course. He retired and he had made a fortune in insurance. But he kept telling me that he hated every second of it. He's like, you know, I provided the lifestyle I liked, but I hated every second of it. And I remember him, I can still see him on the tee getting ready to hit his ball. And he looks at me, he's like, you know, kid, you got to find a way to make work less like work. And then he hit his ball and walked off. And I was like, wow, shit, this orthopedic biomechanics stuff is way too much like work. So I went back to my lab and I finished the PhD just because, you know, I was already 3.5 years into it and I might as well finish it. But I wasn't really sure I wanted an academic job. But then I started, applying for them because just that's what you do after you get a PhD. And I found this job at Cal State Fullerton that was doing sports related research. That really didn't exist too much in Canada. Everything kind of had to be healthcare related or some form of that to get funding for your research. So I came down to Fullerton and I started getting involved in some of these studies and I kind of had free rein to do whatever research I wanted to do. And that's when I think things really took off. And also what really helped was, through grad school, I mean, you don't make a whole lot of money in grad school. So I decided to personal train just to make some extra money. And then I got really into, you know, guys like Greg Cook and Mike Boyle and, some of the big minds in that kind of personal training space, which I think at the time were kind of looked down upon by academics. But I found it to be kind of an avenue or a gap in the literature where people weren't really looking at what these practitioners were doing, these really innovative practitioners. And so I got involved in that and then started reading, you know, Shirley Sarman and Vladimir Yonda's type work. And I thought there was a lot of ways that I could contribute by doing research to kind of show that some of the stuff they were talking about was useful. And I have done a lot of that. And then I got involved into a lot of golf mechanics type research as well. So, it's kind of been, I mean, I think for anyone that's, going through school or anything like that, it is important to find something that you get more satisfaction out of your job rather than just a paycheck. And I was lucky enough to realize that early and find something that has been great. And so that's kind of how I got to where I am. And now I'm a full tenured, full professor at Cal State Fullerton, which is great because I now I have an opportunity to do a whole bunch of different fun stuff in and outside of the university. So it's been a fun journey, taking me a lot of places all over the world. Not right now, but previously I got to travel a lot and meet a lot of people. So it's been fun.
That's amazing. And so how long exactly have you been doing these types of research studies? And have you noticed, you know, a change in terms of either your focus of the research or the outcomes and what you've noticed?
Yeah, I mean, the first research study I did myself was in 2001. I'm old. That was after my undergrad. I think it was around 2001 was the first research study I conducted myself and like wrote up and presented at a conference and then published and stuff. And I think the problem with research to me is it has to be super controlled, right? A good research study controls for every other factor other than the one you're measuring. So you have to control for absolutely everything, which obviously takes away a lot of the practicality of the study a lot of times. And we always have these arguments when we're designing studies. Do we want it to be more practical so that somebody could actually, so it's more like real life, or do we want it to be more research-based where we just control for everything? I feel like most research studies that are published in journal articles are very well controlled, because to publish a study, you have to send it to a whole bunch of peer review people who are other academics who generally bash you if you don't control for all these factors and da 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 da. So I feel like a lot of times research studies aren't very practical and they're very, obviously research based. And I've published a ton and the luster for me of publishing an article and having it sit in a research journal, when I first started, they were in like actual like books in the library where you had to go to the basement and like pull the book out and like photocopy the pages that you wanted. That was a long time ago. But now they're, uphill both ways in the snow, back when I was a kid. Now they're obviously all online, but, you know, I publish these articles and other nerds like me read them, but does it really get out to people? Does it help people, you know, live their lives better or hit a golf ball better? And I wasn't sure that they were doing that. So I think my strengths are in reading a whole bunch of research and seeing what people are doing in the field and kind of assimilating it into one package that I can go and teach a golf teacher how to use some biomechanics information to make a golf teacher better, or a golfer better. And they don't need to know about moment arms or, muscle fiber types, or they don't need to know about all this stuff. They just need to know I think to me where my strengths have come is to, and I think what really helped was teaching at Cal State Fullerton, because Cal State Fullerton students are on average very practical students, right? They don't want to learn trig just for the sake of learning trig. Like every time I had to teach trig to people, people would always put up and say, why in the world do I need to learn this? Like where in my life will I ever have to use this? And I always kind of struggled with an answer to that question because I think about all the stuff we learned in school that we never ever used again ever afterwards. There's so much of it. Yes, being able to take the research and put it into a package. And that's where, I'll find a lot of people that'll post online about, this research article came out and said whatever it said, this, therefore I'm right. And the thing that I do is great. And I always tell my students, research articles are like a brick in the wall, right? So one brick in the wall doesn't do a whole lot. But once you put a whole bunch of bricks and stack them on top of each other and you have a plan of how to arrange those bricks, then, that can tell you, that can build a structure that can actually, tell you something. But putting too much weight into one research article is probably not the best strategy to take, and I think it takes somebody like yourself or Dom or me to kind of read all the research and kind of assimilate it and give you something really simple, and that's what I really like about what you guys are doing, the online stuff that you do. I'm sure some people bash you online for being too simple. Oh, well, you didn't consider this or you didn't consider that, and you're like, yes, but I mean, we know that, but this is not needed for the type of person that's going to be consuming this information right now. So I think that's really important. And we need people like you guys to get that information out to people, to make it simple enough for, Joe Blow, who's sitting in his living room to use the information to make their back feel better or whatever it is. So, I think that's kind of where my career has taken me, which, I'm sure some academics bash me for doing it the way I do it, but, it's whatever. I can sleep at night and I think I'm helping some people. So
Yeah, totally.
I think you're pointing out just something that's so important to start to distinguish. Well, one, I haven't thought about trigonometry in a while, so thanks for bringing that back up for me.
That's my point exactly.
But the whole brick in the house thing, like those research studies, they may be the bricks too. And once you get the full structure, great, we have this full structure of a brick home. But then again, we still have more to add, right?
100%. And like, so two people could look at the same house and be like, this is a piece of crap. Another piece, this is the greatest architectural thing I've ever seen, right? So there's always that human factor and that interpretation of the studies. And that's what I always tell people with research studies. Like, I was looking through, so that one of the original studies that quantified the stretch shortened cycle. And so basically, like a lot of people will say, you know, if you do like a counter movement jump where you stand up, bend down and jump back up, you'll always jump higher than if you do a squat jump, right? Where you bend down and you stay there for a bit. And because that activates little sensors in your muscles that, you know, sense the stretch in your muscles and recoil it to make you jump higher. And well, that study was done in a population of university students. And so on average, like 20-year-old kids have a stretch shortened cycle. But now you take a 55-year-old golfer. Do you think this guy's nervous system still works the way it did when he was 20? Mm. Probably not. And if you only read that study that looked at a population of 20-year-old university students, and in those 20-year-old university students, it was on average they had a stretch shortened cycle. Not every one of them did. Mm. And so that's something we got to start thinking about. Human beings are messy. Anyway, it was a true golf people. A guy came up with this because we do a lot of assessments now on a golfer, because when we teach somebody golf, everybody does it slightly differently. And I think the biggest mistake we used to make in golf is we'd take your 50-year-old guy with a bad back and a knee replacement and put Tiger Woods next to him and say, okay, well, you're not doing this and you're not doing that. Well, obviously he can't do this or that. Like, so we need to figure out a better way for this guy to do it. And so the way that we're teaching golf now is to actually put people through assessments. And I was at a golf conference and I was sitting with a bunch of engineers and I was talking about all the assessments that I do on a golfer before I decide how this golfer should swing the golf club. And this engineer guy who designs golf clubs sat back in his chair and he's like, oh man, I hate working with human beings. They're so messy. And I was like, that's brilliant. Because this guy designs golf clubs and he uses a robot to hit the ball, right? Mm. So basically he moves a little piece of mass from here to there on the golf club and hits the ball. And, you know, oh, that's better because, but it's the robot that does the same thing every time. And unfortunately, you know, human beings don't do that. And there's, you know, there's physical messiness, there's mental messiness, there's so much messiness that goes into human beings. And that's why, you know, research you have to kind of take with a grain of salt. And it again, it adds bricks in the wall, which will help you be a better clinician or, you know, to learn more stuff. But when that human being is standing in front of you as a clinician or a therapist or even yourself, you got to account for all the messiness, which makes it fun, right? You're trying to solve a puzzle every single time you have a client or a patient exactly. in front of you. And I think the best clinicians are the ones who get excited by that challenge of solving that puzzle. And the worst ones are the ones who don't care to even attempt to solve that puzzle and just give them the same old thing.
That I think that's a really cool application that you pulled right there from this whole stretch shortened cycle into even how you educate somebody how to swing a golf club. Like the average right. clinician might take that information and say, oh, we can take advantage of this stretch shortened cycle. I'm just going to have all my golfers bounce into their backswing to get a little more power, you know?
Jeez. Yeah, that's where you get into trouble.
Right? Versus you start working with older people and you say, okay, get into your full backswing, hold, now go forward with your power. That might be more effective. And just looking into some 100%. Of those nuances of the research is going to maybe help you realize, oh, I can't just look at that one takeaway that they like to say in the first line of the study.
Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, I might not get as much because golf teachers and golf instructors, and I'm sure in the fitness world, it's the same. Everybody wants the best exercise or the, you know, thing or and it's complicated. There isn't the thing or the exercise, because if there was, we would have found it by now. A lot of smart minds have been thinking about the golf swing for a long time. And you know, a lot of people that are in similar positions to me will tell you, oh, all you got to do is do this. And everyone, they do those little articles in Golf Digest magazine and everyone's like, oh, that guy's the greatest. But like, and I don't say those things because it's complicated. It's not that easy. And sometimes I'll do an article and say, okay, well, do their little like choose your own adventures, basically a golf instruction manual. So do this. And if this, try this. And if that, try that. And do you guys remember those books, the choose your own adventure books?
Yeah.
You probably don't. You're probably too.
That's the best.
Okay, I thought you might have been too young for those. but to me, that's the way it needs to be. Yeah. And it can still be simple, but be kind of personalized to each individual. And I think that's really cool about what you do, Jen, with your online programs is mm-hmm. you put yourself through a self-assessment, right? And you realize where your issues are, and you then go to that area of your exercises to address those issues that you have. So exactly. It's an educational program as much as it is an exercise program, which is great. Learning more about yourself is the first step, I think.
100%. Thanks for even saying that. but we did want to go into also, I love the fact that before this call, you brought up one of the studies that you had done with FMS, which we can explain what that is, and how that related to your track students and what you kind of, you know, what you guys learned based on what you thought was supposed to happen.
Right. So I think it was like 2002 or so, I got a job at a gym up in Canada. It's called Good Life Fitness. It was like the 24-hour fitness of gyms. It was like the chain gym. And I was lucky enough that there was a couple other trainers there that were really, you know, into this stuff and learning about stuff. And they introduced me to this guy named Gray Cook. And so I went and watched him speak at a bunch of conferences, and he's a really engaging speaker and a really smart guy. And his biggest, you know, theory is, and the first line of his most recent book says, you have to move well before you can move often. Mm. And the problem is most of us get that backwards. So I always call it the kind of New Year's resolution phenomenon, right? So everybody wakes up on January 1st and, you know, they've been partying and eating for a couple or a month straight or whatever, like, I got to get in shape. And so what do? They go to the gym and they add quantity of movement, right? They run and they work out and they lift weights. And then what does the gym look like? February 1st is generally pretty empty. Well, there are gyms are all empty right now, but back in regular times, what did the gym look like? And so why is that? I mean, a lot of people talk about motivation, and I don't think people are inherently lazy. I think, you know, when they go to the gym, you know, their back starts to hurt or their knee starts to hurt or you know, it just sucks because it's so difficult to move because they're working against all these restrictions and all these imbalances in their bodies that just don't allow them to move. I think if we got people moving better, this is this whole theory, they would move more and then we would have all the benefits that we know movement provides to you. So that's kind of the whole theory behind his whole thing. And the only problem was, how the heck do I know if I'm moving well or not? And that was his thing when he first invented the FMS, was to give us an idea of how well am I moving? And I think, you know, the FMS, obviously tons of people have bashed it saying it's not this and it's not that, but Gray Cook says, hey, before this we had nothing. Now we got something. So mm-hmm. whatever. Like, yeah. And I think, you know, I'm sure you guys use elements of it. Like, I mean, I'm sure you guys watch a client squat when you do an assessment, or watch the lunge, or, you know, I mean, and I'm sure it can get, obviously, you know, they've expanded it now to the FSMA and all those other assessments that are much more clinically based, but it is the first thing that assesses how well you're moving. And so I've introduced this to my students throughout my time at Fullerton, because I think it's such a valuable, even if it's not a valuable tool, it's a valuable thought process. Like, understanding that, hey, I should probably look at how I'm moving before I start moving a lot, just to see if there's any little wacky things that are happening there. And I always tell my students that, like, my ultimate goal for my job at Cal State Fullerton is for, at some point, one of my students to come back to me and say, Dr. Lynn, you're full of shit. Because what would have happened to make that process happen is they would have listened to me and talked whatever I was talking about, and gone out into the field and tried it, figured it out, and maybe found out it doesn't work so well. Mm-hmm. And I told them, if they come back and tell me about it, that'll be great, because then we'll all learn something. And hasn't happened yet, but I'm still waiting. We'll see. But anyway, so we did a study on this FMS, because what I found was, which was really interesting, there were several studies that did these prospective longitudinal analyses where they take a group of people that are perfectly healthy and they measure a whole bunch of things about them. And then they watch them for, like, it can be months, it can be years, it can be, and then they bring them back in to see, you know, or sometimes you don't even have to bring them back in. You just determine who got hurt or who developed this condition and who didn't. So then you can see early, was there something about how they were moving before that might have caused these issues, you know, down the road. So they're one of the most powerful types of study, I think, they're probably the biggest bricks in the wall, I would say, that when I read research are these prospective kind of longitudinal analyses. So we did one with the track team, because in the literature, you know, they had done it with NFL football players, they had done it with military trainees, they had done it with, and one study did it with, like, a whole whack of athletes at a university. So like every intercollegiate athlete, they did it with them. But the cool thing about track, and I didn't really realize this until afterwards, the reason we chose the track team was because my student who wanted to do this study was the athletic trainer for the track team. So basically we had access to them. Like every person who got injured would go see him so that he could take notes and be really controlled about knowing who got hurt and who didn't, and how many days of practice they missed and all that kind of stuff. And so that's the reason we chose the track team. And we kind of got lucky because track athletes in an NCAA program, and we only did the runners. We didn't do the jumpers or the throwers. But the runners run straight and turn left. They never turn right from, what is it, November till May. They're like Zoolander, right? They never turn. Do you guys know that movie, or am I dating myself again? I always have to qualify it because in my classes, I talked about like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, I think, one day, and people were like, who, Ferris what? And I'm like, oh my God, you guys know that movie?
Like Zoolander minus Blue Steel.
Yeah. Anyways, we did it with the track team. So we measured them at the start of their season, and everybody had to fill out a form saying, yes, I'm perfectly healthy right now. I have no issues. And then they play their sport the whole season, and we tracked who got hurt. And the FMS is a scoring system. So it's scored from 0 to 21. And so if you score a 0, that's the worst you could possibly move. And if you score a 21, that's the best you could possibly move from the scoring system. And the theory is the better you move, the less likely you are to get injured. And there's some research showing that if you score above a 14, if you're an NFL football player, you're way less likely to get injured than if you score below a 14. So the theory has always been score better, move better, get hurt less. So we did our whole study. We went through the whole thing. And at the end of the study, we found that the people who scored higher on the FMS were more likely to be injured. And I was like, wait, what? And I had to go through my notes and figure out did I do this right? Did I forget to carry the two, or what happened here? How did I mess this up? But it was right. That's what we found, which was the complete opposite of what my hypothesis was. And when I started to look back on it, I started to think about, and I talked about this lady once before, Shirley Sarman, who is kind of one of the pioneers in this area. She's a physical therapist from Washington University in St. Louis, and written a bunch of great books and talked about, a lot of this kind of movement quality stuff. And one of the things that she has always said is in order to maintain good musculoskeletal health, you need to have variety in your movements and postures. And when I try to teach this to my students, I always make the analogy to nutrition, right? So I always ask my students, broccoli is good for you, right? Would anybody in this room argue that broccoli is not a nutritious, healthy food? And nobody ever puts up their hand and says no. I'm like, but what if you ate broccoli and only broccoli for every meal of every single day? You think you'd get sick? Probably. And so we need to have variety in our nutrition. We need to have variety in our movements and postures if we're going to stay healthy. And so to me, I think that and this is the story we went back to the study, the reason that the people who move very well in the FMS, and if you watch people that move very well, they kind of move very in plane. There's never any out of plane motion. They're never kind of flinging their leg around. And the one movement that kind of came back to me was there's a movement where you have to stand and put your foot over a string. It's called the hurdle step. If you Google FMS hurdle step, you'll see kind of what it looks like. But you just have to reach your foot over a string, touch it to the ground, and bring it back. And the people who do it really well move like a robot, right? They kind of move in the sagittal plane the whole time, or kind of in a straight ahead motion. And the people who don't do it very well have a bunch of weird motions, like they either fling their leg out to the side, or they bend their trunk forward or sideways, or they do a bunch of crazy things to try to get their leg over the hurdle. And I remember when I was scoring these FMS tests, there was one of the runners who did all these crazy things when he was doing the hurdle step. And so I scored him down on that particular test and said, he wasn't very good. And I kind of laughed about it and moved on. And then when I got the results, I was like, wait a second, I wonder if that guy got hurt. And so I went back and looked at my notes, and he was one of the ones who stayed healthy. And so to me, I think you have to get variability in your movement from somewhere. And I think the reason why football players who move better on the FMS don't get hurt is because they get the variety from their sport. Like, what do you do in football? Can you name one thing you do in football? No, you're falling down, you're getting up, you're running backwards, you're running sideways, you're running forwards. There's so much variety in what you do every day as a football player that if you move better on the FMS, you don't get hurt. You can have not enough variability and you can have too much variability. Whereas if you don't move well in the FMS and you're a football player, there's just too much wackiness happening, and then you probably get hurt. Whereas if I'm a track runner and I just do the same things every day, I run straight and turn left, and then I go to the gym and I squat and I lunge, and everything's kind of forward, straight ahead, motions. And then I move very well in the FMS. That's just too much stress in one particular area, not enough variety. And I get hurt. Where do we get the variability from in track athletes? Because I really struggled because I had to go meet with the track coaches after this study was done because they allowed us to use their athletes. So they wanted to know what they found. So that it just in case it could help them, you know. And I remember walking into their offices and say, okay. And I told them that whole story, how, you know, we got to introduce more variability into their movements. And I said, how about on Wednesdays we turn right? And they're like, blasphemy, never would we ever do that. But you have to run straight and turn left and track. And I'm like, all right, okay, so what else can we do? I remember I said, well, how about like once a week you play a little soccer game so that people are like moving in different directions and not just running straight and turning left all the time. And they're like, no, they're going to roll their ankles and they're going to injure themselves. We're not doing that either. And I'm like, oh, like what else could I got for you? And then what I started to think about was in the gym. Like, what can we do in the gym? And I think that's where, you know, for really intense athletes or, you know, really elite athletes, the gym during the season becomes the time that we undo all the bad stuff we do to ourselves in our sports. Mm-hmm. You don't really use the gym as an elite athlete to get better at your sport. I remember I was at an NSCA conference one year, the National Strength Conditioning Association, and the Indianapolis Colts strength coach got up to speak. And I was like, oh, this one's going to be good. This is going to be about powerlifting and like how to get these guys strong and fast. And this is going to be awesome. I was all pumped up. And his first line was, when I first got hired by the Indianapolis Colts, the owner brought me into his office and he says, as our strength coach, you have three jobs. One, don't hurt my players. Two, if they're hurt, don't let them get hurt. Or once they get better, don't get them hurt again. And then three, make sure they're ready to play on Sunday. And I was like, wait, there was nothing in there that was like, make them strong, make them fast, make them. And basically the owner's theory was, I'm going to draft guys who are strong, fast, and can throw a ball and catch a ball and do all the things you need to play football. Your job is to do those three things. And so the gym really becomes keeping them from getting injured and undoing all the bad things they do to themselves with their sport. And so if you are an elite athlete, and I do a lot of work in golf, and golf's a very rotational sport. And so you'll have a golfer that'll go to the driving range and hit 300 golf balls and then go to the gym and do rotational med ball throws and chops and lifts and rotational work. And I'm like, that's a lot of rotational stuff. And then they wonder why their back hurts at the end of it. And so to me, introducing variety in our movements and postures is one of the key things that pretty much anybody can do to avoid getting injured. I do a lot of sitting in my job when I'm reading and writing research articles and doing all that kind of stuff. And when I'm sitting, I'm in kind of a flex spine posture. It's kind of a bending forward posture. And then I get in my car and I drive home. And when I start to feel a little, you know, iffy in my back, I'll lie on the floor at home with a pillow under my chest and watch TV that night. So that puts me into extension. And that makes my back feel better because it's giving me variety, right? It's taking me out of, I always say it gives me some cauliflower or something different, right? Not broccoli all the time. I'm getting something other than that to give me the variety to keep me healthy. So I think that's something that anybody who moves or anybody who's a human can use to help them feel better is to introduce some variety into their movements and postures to try to keep themselves healthy. Because if we do the same things over and over again, that's going to lead to problems down the road somewhere.
Exactly. That's what I say all the time. It's like the best posture is the next posture. It's not like we're looking for one static place. We're looking to do something different.
Right.
And a lot of what you're saying too is I hear the issue of athlete specialization, early athlete specialization and overtraining within our sport popping out at me because you're saying, oh, our sport is generally where we, you know, have these compensations and then we need to train ourselves out of it. Well, what do we do now these days is we push our kids into doing that sport more and more and only that sport by the time they're like 8 years old. And I think that that is really unfortunate because we're losing a lot of that variability.
100%. And if you look at like a lot, I mean, I've seen, you know, social media posts and articles about this. And if you look at a lot of the top athletes in our world right now, so his name is escaping me right now, the quarterback who won the Super Bowl this year from Kansas City. What's his name again?
Oh, Mahomes, Patrick Mahomes.
Mahomes. Yeah. He was a really good baseball player. Like they went through a laundry list of different sports he played, like right up even through high school or even into college. Yeah. I think he was playing all these different sports. So to me, I don't think, I mean, if you're a good athlete, you will still, you know, excel above everyone and get your excel to the highest levels. I think that's where, you know, people think, oh, if I'm going to be at a highest level, I just have to concentrate on only this sport and only this sport. But we're seeing a lot of evidence now that, you know, variety is something. Because if you do only one sport and get injured, then you can't play your sport at all. And then that's, yeah. that's probably not going to help your performance as well. So I think that's one of the simplest concepts that I think anybody could use to make themselves feel and move better, is just to try to introduce some variety in what you're doing.
Yeah. And I think that that's just something that's sometimes hard to get across to the athletes or the parents. So one thing that we do want to dive into now is something that Jen and I have started using recently. And I also know a company that you've been involved a little bit with, but Koba Board. And we're going to talk into Koba Board and how it helps us access this hinge motion a little bit more and really get our glutes popping. So can you talk into a little bit of where this concept came from and how you got involved?
Yeah. So as I was doing my personal training through grad school, I noticed that people's squat patterns were awful. People just generally cannot squat very well. And so, you know, putting a weight on your back to squat in a pattern that already wasn't very good with no weight on you, I thought was probably not the smartest thing to do. And then I started to mess around with things, and I found one way that I could really help improve people's squats was to do something called a counterbalance squat. So what I would do is I have them hold dumbbells in their hands, and then as they squatted down, they would bring the dumbbells out in front of them. And then as they squatted up, they would bring the dumbbells back to their side. So basically, they were putting the dumbbells out in front of them, which counterbalanced them and allowed them to push their hips back and kind of hinge through their hips better, so that it was more of kind of a hip dominant movement rather than just like shooting your knees forward and lowering down to the ground. And I found that like it was super easy to get people to squat better using that little strategy. And so when I got to Fullerton, I did a biomechanical study on that, where I looked at the torques or the moments on the knee and the hip and the EMG of the knee extensors and the hip extensors as we did a counterbalance squat versus a regular squat. And I ended up publishing that in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research. And it's basically, we found the counterbalance squat put more, you know, torque on your hip and activated your hip extensors. So you're using your glutes a lot more than your quads, what the EMG told us. And then our motion capture and our biomechanical analysis told us that you're basically hinging through your hip and putting more external torques or forces on the hip as well. So basically, through a movement assessment and through an EMG assessment, I thought that the counterbalance squat was trained a much more efficient pattern of movement. And so I published that and didn't think about it for a couple of years. It sat in one of those journals that, you know, nerds like me read, and hopefully not many other people. But luckily, this guy, Jim Duffy from the New York area, was searching for stuff like that because he had invented this little board that he thought helped people move better. So he invented this little exercise board. And when he first showed it to me, it was a wooden thing that he made in his garage. And he thought that, like, and he said he'd been, you know, messing around with it and using it. And he said his wife or somebody he knew, like, had really bad knees. And she's like, man, like, I can't squat anymore. My knee. And then he got her on that board, and she's like, oh my God, my knees don't hurt anymore. Like, I can squat and I can actually do movements, on this board. And so he didn't really know what he was doing biomechanically. He just kind of, I don't know how, I mean, I'm sure you probably could get him on here. He could tell you the story of how he invented it or what went through his head to get it to where it is. But, so he brought it to me and said, I would like you to kind of do a study on this. And if it sucks, tell me that. Like, I'm totally fine with that. Just like, and so he commissioned a study that I did, looking at this board, and it basically is kind of the same theory as the counterbalance squat that I did but there's bands in front of you instead of weights. And the board's kind of tilted, towards your heels. So your toes are higher than your heels, and there's a little, bump underneath your toes, which puts you in a little more kind of dorsiflex position. Which kind of forces people, I think, to hinge their hips and perform a better squat, which we did our EMG study and it showed that it activated more glutes and less quads, which I think would be, I mean, generally, you know, the general theory is that a quad dominant movement pattern is generally a bad pattern. People who overuse their knee joints, as they move, is something that's probably not quite as efficient as using a more hip dominant pattern where we have bigger, stronger muscles and a much more stable and well-designed joint. And so this thing is, and it's super simple, right? I mean, you guys have one. It's a slanted board with some bands attached to it. Like, it's not complicated. But I think, why does it have to be complicated? And this is, so we did some research on it, and I did some, you know, pilot testing with the people around, and some of the students that I used, that I put it, you know, used it. They said, I don't like it that much because I can't put enough weight on it to help me. And I'm like, well, maybe this thing isn't for you. And that's the thing with any tool, right? Any tool is not for everyone. But I think, you know, if you're going to do some squats in your living room and you have the option of, or you don't have anything, you're just going to do kind of body weight squats, having this thing under your bed and pulling this thing out. It makes it much easier to do a more biomechanically efficient squat. Is it going to be perfect? Probably not, but it'll probably, I mean, if you have some of these issues that are common in a lot of people that live in our society, then it could be a lot better. And that's something that I liked getting on board with, because it's a simple solution to a common biomechanical problem. And you don't have to, doesn't have to come with an instruction manual. I mean, you can just kind of hop on it and put it together, and most people will get more efficient movement patterns out of using this thing. And I know you guys have, I mean, that's the coolest thing about getting it in your hands, because I've seen some exercises that you guys have done that I never even would have considered. So that's the cool part about it, is it's very simple, but it has multiple uses. So, and again, that's kind of been my goal, right? Is to make things as simple as possible. So good movement information, or people can move better so they can move more. And I think that's Greg Cook's philosophy, and I've kind of adopted that as well. And I think this is a simple tool that could really help a lot of people do that.
Exactly. And that's why we love it. Like, at first it was kind of like, oh, here's a little board, I don't know about it. And then you actually start really moving on it and using it. And even though, yeah, it's just bands, you can make it so effective because of the positioning that it puts you in.
Yeah. I don't know if you said that there's people who don't think that they can load that thing up enough, but the bands it comes with, let me tell you, every time I deadlift and squat on that thing, I can feel it the next day, and I can feel the muscles that it kind of biases me into with those, like you said, natural external cues it gives you, where it just raises the toes, puts some weight out in front of you, and immediately internally your body starts doing all these things differently. So you don't need to have somebody sitting there cueing you a million times. You do a couple of these external things to the body that help drive these internal processes. And that's what I love about it so much. And I get sore during it, and I used to squat and deadlift very, very heavy weights in college. So,
right. But I've seen you, you're wrapping stuff around your neck, and you're doing stuff like that. I never even thought you could do that. So that's the cool stuff, right? You've figured out ways, and that's what innovative, you know, smart clinicians will do. And I mean, I would have never even thought to do stuff that I've seen you do on it. So that's awesome. I mean, I think that's what I try to teach my students, is, hey, we got to be innovative. We got to think outside the box. And you've taken this little tool and taken it to dimensions that, and that's why I wanted you guys involved as well, because I knew you guys would do stuff like that to it. So it's been awesome.
Yeah, it's been so fun.
And it kind of brings you around to your initial point when you, and this is what I was feeling when I was thinking about like social media and Instagram stuff, like, oh, what's the need for all that noise? But again, you meet someone like Jen who's doing it so authentically and so beautifully and has this amazing connection with people that when you do have good information to get out, it gives you a good way to get that out. And so people like you connecting and inspiring people like Jen is going to continue to help get all this amazing information out. And I know that we've been super excited to work with it and have loved it and are excited to continue to do so.
Totally. And it's the way of the world now. I remember when I was on Facebook, I don't know, back when I was doing my PhD and stuff. And then this Instagram thing came out and somebody was telling me about it. And I'm like, what do you do with it? And they're like, well, you post pictures and you comment and you like, and I'm like, Facebook does that already. Like, this is garbage. No one's ever going to use this thing. And apparently I was dead wrong. So what are you going to do? I admit it. It's the way of the world now. And I think this is the way people get their news, is the way people get their information. And so we need good information out there, because there is a lot of not so good stuff. So promoting stuff like what you guys do is awesome.
Well, we're going to have you back on so we can make sure that we're keeping up with our evidence.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. And me too.
But honestly, Scott, we just appreciate you so much. I just, again, love how you teach, love how you make it applicable to everyday life and what you're doing. It's just, it's incredible.
Yeah, right back at you guys. I think what you guys are doing is incredible. And I mean, I don't know how you do it. I post like once every 3 months, and that's enough for me. And you guys are on there every day. So we need people to do stuff like you're doing, and that's awesome. So I think that's what you got to figure out, what your strengths are, and roll with it. And you guys are definitely doing an awesome job at what you do. So I'm happy to support it any way I can.
Thank you. Well, I'm sure we'll have you back on and have people asking questions of what they want to know about the research. So
awesome. Sounds good. We've gone way over our 30-minute limit here, so I apologize.
You're all good. It's all good information.
Exactly. It's all things people need to know. But we'll talk to you soon. Cool. Thanks, Scott.
There we go. Yet again, another amazing guest. And if you haven't yet checked out that Kobo board that Jen and I were talking with Dr. Lin about, go check it out. I don't know if you've heard yet, but Jen and I have a code for it. If you use code DocGenFit, then you can get 10% off that Kobo board. But it's just a really lightweight, low profile piece of equipment that you can use in your home to do those squats, to do those deadlifts, to get yourself hinging, to feel what it feels like to get those glutes popping just that little bit more. So go click the link in the show notes and use code DocGenFit and you can get 10% off that board to start hinging and getting those glutes popping today. And there we have it, yet another amazing guest on the Optimal Body Podcast. So now what we ask of you, if you loved any bit of that or resonated with it, go share it out, share it with a friend, share it on your social media, because you know there are more people out there that would resonate with it just the same. Also, subscribe, rate, review on your favorite podcast app so we know what you want to learn or other guests that you think we should bring on for you in the future. Keep tuning in to find your optimal body.